My guest today is John Ramsey. John is no stranger to WWUH. He's the general manager of the University of Hartford's FM station, WWUH. John is webmaster of HartfordRadioHistory.com and also of ColdWarCT.com. His recent book, Hartford Radio History, was published in 2012. John is also president of Ramsey Communications Services, a broadcast engineering consulting firm, and is also chief technical officer of WCCC Radio, which is the licensee of WAPJ in Torrington. And John is also chairman of the Society of Broadcast Engineers local chapter. John, you're a busy man. I'm glad you were able to spend a few minutes with me here.
It's great to be here, Dave. Thank you.
John, since I've been at the station, well, I joined in 2002. I've known you pretty well since then, and I know you to be a very wise and conscientious station manager, good personnel manager, and I know that you have tremendous devotion and dedication to this radio station and what it represents. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your background, your connection to University of Hartford, as well as the background of the radio station, WWUH, and its connection to the University of Hartford.
Sure. The radio station goes back 45 years. We're celebrating our 45th anniversary this summer in July. It was started by a handful of students. Clark Schmidt is one of the folks that was a student here in the mid-60s, whose name is still associated with being one of the founders of the radio station. Clark came to the campus in 65 or 66 and realized that the campus didn't have a radio station. He was a student here, and he really felt that we should have one. Trinity College had one, UConn had one, Wesleyan had one, and he was a radio guy. He'd actually, by the time he got here as a freshman, had already worked in commercial radio, and he thought the campus deserved a radio station. And he thought that the radio station would do a lot of good things for the campus community and also for the surrounding community. So it took him 3 or 4 years to convince the president of the university and the board of regents and ultimately the FCC to grant a license for the radio station that is now WWH. And he succeeded because on July 15th, 1968, the FCC approved his application or the university's application for a 1,000-watt FM station, which was and is pretty big. And the rest is history, as they say, Dave. The station's been on, as I said, for 45 years. And if it wasn't for the folks like Clark, the students that did all the work and the belief in what they were doing. I mean, the President Woodruff, the president of the university, supported them 100%. Clark would be the first one to tell you that without President Woodruff, we wouldn't be able to do it. The Board of Regents had to sign off on it because as an FCC licensee, that has to be done. And he built it all, or he designed it all and planned it all without any funding. And at the last minute, the family of Lewis K. Roth, who was a regent here, who had passed away in 1966, the Lewis K. Roth family donated $40,000 to fund the radio station. But Clark was very resourceful. He had a ton of equipment donated. In fact, the transmitter, which is the most expensive item and one of the most hard to get, was donated by WTIC. WTIC Radio in Hartford has been incredibly generous over the last 40 years and really was responsible for putting us on the air originally.
It's remarkable. And your background, your connection to the radio station and
the
university?
It's 1970. I'm a 15-year-old. This is pre-computer geeks because computers didn't exist, at least in the home setting. But I was a bit of a radio geek. I was a ham radio operator. I actually had my own little pirate radio station that covered about four or five houses in my neighborhood. So, it technically was not legal because it didn't have a license. It was pretty victimless crime type thing, and kind of sat in my basement doing radio shows for myself. And I had some friends come in and do that, but I think my dad was a little bit worried about what the future of his son would be. So he saw an article in the newspaper, I think it was late 1969, about WWUH going on the air, and brought me down here for a tour in late 1969. And I got a tour in the afternoon or early evening. A young lady, a student here, gave me a tour. Her name is Jerry. It was the first time I'd ever seen a real radio station. So it was really cool, and I started volunteering in 1970 when I was 15, and I kind of never left.
I didn't realize that you and the station go back so far.
Not to the very beginning, but almost, and I was here for a few years, 3 or 4 years, and I actually went away for maybe 5 or 6 years, and I came back. So I've really been here pretty much, I won't say full-time, but since 1977 is when I re-engaged with the station.
Were you a student at the University?
I was a student after, yeah, I came in here as 15. I took a bunch of classes at Ward College because I got bitten by the radio bug, and radio engineering was my fascination, and I wanted to get a job in that field. And to do that, you had to have, back then, to have a first-class FCC license. And I had a lot of practical experience, more or less self-taught with a lot of the hands-on stuff. But to pass the FCC test, I needed to get some book learning. So I went to Ward College at night while I was working full-time during the day to get the information I needed to pass the test.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about the radio station itself. How is it organized? How is it staffed? How is it financed? What is its mission? Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'll talk about the mission first. Clark gets credit for coming up with the station philosophy, which was in 1968 and still is informally something for everyone. And shortly after Clark put the station on the air, I think about a year afterwards in 1969, somebody on the staff coined the phrase public alternative radio. We were Hartford's public alternative radio station 5 or 6 years before public radio existed in this country as identifiable thing. There were public stations before that, but it wasn't really known as public radio. So the philosophy of public alternative radio has stuck with us for 44 years, and I think it's what makes the station successful, and I think it's what has kept the station going strong this entire time. The idea was to have programming that was unlike that which was on other stations, but to present it in a professional fashion. So this public alternative radio, because anybody can go on and just play anything. You can just go on and set your iPod playlist to random and play country music and classical music and have Shostakovich followed up by Conway Twitty, followed up by the Beatles. That's not good programming. You know, if somebody wants to hear that, that's fine, but the average person doesn't. So the philosophy had always been to provide stuff that isn't being played elsewhere, but to present it in a very professional sounding style. And of course, being professional means you're paid. And one of the things is, here at since day one, none of our programmers have ever been paid. And frankly, I don't think most of them want to be paid. They do it as a labor of love. So it's the public alternative radio philosophy that we've carried on for all these years that makes the station so unique and I think such a success.
And where does the money come from?
The money comes predominantly from the listeners, the cash money. We are part of the University of Hartford. We're licensed to the University of Hartford. So the UH has always been, we wouldn't exist if it wasn't for them. Originally, we wouldn't have been able to start, and we wouldn't be able to continue. They give us tons of in-kind services. The building that we're sitting in, these top-notch studios were built by the University of Hartford. They give us electricity, air conditioning, heat, parking services, public safety services, a million different things that add up to hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million a year if you had to go out and rent this in the real world with insurance and electricity. And on top of that, they give us a cash stipend. But as the mission of the station changed over the years from serving just the student body to becoming a community resource. We are, you know, the community voice of the university. Along with that, the cost of running an institution of higher education has gone up, and the economy has not gotten much stronger. So over the years, we've weaned ourselves away from the university as far as cash money goes because we've been able to supplement it with our listeners. Our listeners have been so generous to be able to fund the station. So about 90% of our income comes directly from our listeners and less than 10% from the University of Hartford, as it should be. The University of Hartford's main priority should be serving the students. We serve the students both because we have students on the staff. We teach them broadcasting. We teach them how to run an arts organization, among other things. And we have students, many students that are listeners. But with a signal that covers potentially 1 million people off campus, it wouldn't be right if the students had to pay for the station by themselves. So we don't get any student activity money. That money goes into things that students use on a routine basis. And the listeners help foot the bill for the radio station because they're the beneficiaries of it.
Could you say a little bit more about the programming? How the station determines what sort of programming should go at what time of day?
Sure. We have a block format, which is a little bit unusual to radio in this country. We're so used to in America that a radio station, it's the sports station, it's the classical station, it's the rock station, it's the country station. One station has one format. Our philosophy of having a little bit of something for everyone is based on having a public service license and us wanting to cover in service as many different publics as we can, as many different segments of society that we can that are underserved by radio. Because the University of Hartford does not own the license. WTIC does not own the license for 1080. We're all public trustees. We're granted licenses to use the station for 7 years, and then we have to renew it again. And we're supposed to be operating, in the famous phrase, if you're in broadcasting, the public interest, convenience, and necessity. A commercial station like WTIC has one of their main goals to serve the public, but also to serve the shareholders, to make money. It's a profit-making business, and that's fine. As a nonprofit station, we have the advantage. We wouldn't want to change that. We're not allowed to have commercials. We wouldn't want them. We get to do programming that we think is the right programming for the audience and not have to worry about whether the advertisers want to support it or whether an advertiser doesn't like that subject because it's too controversial or whatever. We can do good programming the way our volunteers think it should be done, and the listeners respond very wonderfully and very generously during our fund drive. So we have what's called a block format, which is familiar to Americans with television. You know, if you have a special show that you want to watch every week, Masterpiece Theater or whatever, you know it's on Sunday nights at 9 o'clock, and you may work your schedule around that. Of course, with DVRs now and TiVo, it's different. But, you know, growing up, we all used to, you know, have a favorite TV show or two. Well, our programming's like that. We have for the same type of programming on Monday through Friday. We have 6 to 9 in the morning, we have folk and acoustic music. From 9 to 12, we have jazz. At noontime, we have a public affairs hour. So people have an expectation of when their favorite shows might be on. As a manager of an alternative station, Dave, I'd be embarrassed if we had the same jazz announcer on. All of them are good. Any one of them would be worthy of it. But we have 9 jazz shows every week, 27 hours, and we have 9 different hosts doing it. So it gives, so one guy or gal may be really into blue, a big band, and somebody else may be into swing stuff, and somebody may be into more modern jazz. So it gives a huge variety. There's 69 different programs, 69 different programmers, and a huge variety of music, pretty much none of which is duplicated on the commercial airwaves, and a lot of it isn't even duplicated in the other college and public stations. Now that public radio has pretty much given up, at least in Connecticut, on music, we are doing more, and we hear from people, you know, that we're doing more as from a music standpoint for Connecticut's public than Connecticut Public Radio does. And Connecticut Public Radio is a fine station, and their niche is in doing news and spoken word programming. Our niche is more often than not doing music programming, which works out very well for us.
Now, you mentioned just now Connecticut Public Radio. Does the station have any affiliation with Connecticut Public Radio? Has it ever had in the past? Would it want to in the future?
Not a direct affiliation. We know we work with the people over there on different projects and publicity, things that are mutually beneficial to both stations. But they really have, I won't say a different agenda, but they have their own, because the radio station is part of the TV service that they've got, which is huge. It's a big business with 100 employees. It's run differently. We coexist. We look at them as our brethren or our sisters in broadcasting, but we don't work with them too closely on things. Mm-hmm. It's easier now. They used to have folk music and they used to have jazz. It was a little bit more competitive that way. Now that they're just doing spoken word programming, we're really proud of the spoken word programs we have here, the public affairs shows like this one and some of the other ones that we produce. But there's really no comparison. You know, if you want to listen to All Things Considered, which is an NPR program, you're going to listen to All Things Considered. We can provide an alternative to that if you don't. In fact, one of the things that we've historically done, Dave, and I know you're on the classic staff here as well, for decades, public radio, not just Hartford, but Amherst and Albany. Amherst and Albany ran 4 o'clock in the afternoon, All Things Considered, which is a great show, as I mentioned. But not everybody, when they were driving home, wanted to hear about the latest bombing or the latest shooting or the latest whatever. So we put on classical music starting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Monday through Friday, to give people an alternative. And then when that was over, people could turn back to public radio if they wanted to, and we'd end up doing jazz or something else back then. So it was a good combination of two stations. Now that doesn't apply quite as much because they're not playing any classical music at all at public radio, by and large.
Are there other ways in which our music and talk show distribution has changed over the years?
Well, yeah, two different things have happened in over the years. One was we've added on 3 other stations, sister stations, we call them, small stations in other parts of the state that fill in some weak spots. We've got a decently strong signal for a mid-sized university, but it's not as big as WTIC or FM or one of the other commercial stations. They have 50,000-watt signals that cover 3 or 4 states. We have about a 1,000-watt signal that covers about a third of Connecticut and part of Massachusetts. We're glad we've got it, but we've been able to supplement that in Torrington and in Somers and in Wallingford, 3 towns with this decent amount of population, but also because of terrain and hills don't pick up our signal very well. So we are broadcast on those stations and hours when those local stations aren't having their own programming. The last thing we want to do is take over somebody else's station. We approach these stations and said, listen, when you don't have your own programming on, why don't you put us on instead of just going off the air? So it's a good thing for us, and it really helps them as well. And, of course, the Internet has been huge. We were I said until recently that we were the second station in the state to broadcast on the Internet 24 hours a day. It turns out we're the first. We beat WTIC by about a year. We started in 1996 streaming 24 hours a day and have a large audience. We've heard from probably 30 or 40 countries over the 15 or 20 years that we've been streaming, listeners around the world that tune in for particularly for some of our specialty shows like the Polka Show and the Italian Show, but tune in for some of the other more mainstream shows too, like jazz and classics. So this little radio station sitting in the basement of the Gray Center here on campus has a worldwide following, which is pretty cool. Nobody would have imagined that 20 years ago before the internet broadcasting took off. So we're really proud of that, and it's something that gets the name of the university out to reaches of the country and the world that might not otherwise have heard of UH.
Just tell us a little bit more about those specialty programs, what they are now and perhaps what they've been in previous years. if there's been an evolution?
The station's philosophy, as I mentioned, has always been to bring a voice to the voiceless, to serve different segments of society that are underserved. And because of the nature of broadcasting in America is predominantly commercial radio, they have to make a profit in doing what they're doing. For decades, before the FCC deregulated things in the 90s, most Saturday and Sunday mornings on the small AM stations had foreign language programming. I started in commercial radio back in the early 70s, working at an AM station in West Hartford, running the board, being a board op, as they called it, for a little AM country music station that on the weekends ran Polish and Lithuanian and Spanish and Portuguese programming. When radio was deregulated and the value of radio stations went up, there's no space for that anymore. Commercial stations, by and large, don't offer space to community groups that want to have programming. So we've filled that void more and more by offering local community groups and individuals representing different segments to come in and do programming. So we are we are many different radio stations to many different people, and we're doing what I think every radio station should do is not just doing mass marketing. We should be able to do narrowcasting. I didn't coin that phrase, but the average WWH listener doesn't want to listen to a program in the Lithuanian language. And yet we have a two-hour Lithuanian program on Sundays that is very popular with the Lithuanian community and others, and it's something that a public station should do. We should give back to the community by allowing airtime for people to talk to their constituents and their communities.
And which other foreign language programs do we broadcast?
We have Italian and Portuguese and Spanish and Lithuanian are the four foreign languages. We also have Polish programming and West Indian programming and East Indian programming as well.
Are there plans to include other language programs as the demographics of Greater Hartford change?
Yes. The only trouble with doing that, we're always interested in programming ideas. To put something on means taking something off. It's like a Rubik's Cube. In fact, if you remember, you're my age, Dave, the little kids' toys with the alphabet, and you'd have one extra slot, and you'd move the letters or numbers around to try and do it. Our programming is like that. When an opening comes up, we may go to somebody saying, you've been waiting on the waiting list, can you do this show? And they go, oh, no, I can't do Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock. I'm not free then. I'm never free on the weekends. How about a Tuesday? Well, that's a whole other problem. You got to move things around. So we're always interested in new programming. Programming does evolve here. It changes, and hopefully it's getting better all the time. But finding, even when you have an opening, finding a volunteer that can do something at that time can be problematic.
I'm talking today with John Ramsey. I know John as the station manager of WWUH, the University of Hartford's FM station. Does the university ask the station to broadcast any particular programs, or does the university have any editorial position on our programming schedule?
As the licensee of the radio station, the university has always had absolute control. The FCC would not be happy at all if they found a situation where a licensee wasn't involved at all and wasn't aware of what was going on at the station. The university has sanctioned the station. I mean, they approved the station on day one. We wouldn't have the station without them. And all along, they've been incredibly supportive. But I think due to certainly the professionalism and the dedication of the early volunteers, I know Clark would tell you, Clark Schmidt, the founder of the station, who was a student here back in the mid-60s, there was a concern that the universities would allow these students to go on the air and have access to the public, independent of any type of oversight by the university, at least at any type of moment-by-moment oversight. And it has worked so well for us. We've never, knock on wood, we've never had a scandal, we've never had a FCC complaint, we've never had a lawsuit about our programming. So the university is very much aware of what we do here. They sanction what we do here, and they've just been incredibly supportive. They've asked us to do some of the ball games, which is why we have the Women's Hawks on here, and that works out wonderfully for us. But I think they realize they've got a real good thing going, and they trust the people that are here and to do what's right. And we realize that we have to do that because we're so lucky to have access to the license and to be able to represent the university 24 hours a day. We're on the air. One thing is said inappropriately, and you can get sued in this country. I mean, people can sue people over the silliest things. So we have a responsibility to represent University of Hartford professionally and properly to the audience at large.
Now, there is also another radio station on the campus of the university. Isn't that correct?
Sure. There's a student station that calls themselves WSAM. They're not actually authorized by the FCC because they don't need to be. They just cover the campus with an AM signal, and they're also an internet broadcaster. It's paid for by indirectly through student activity fees. It's one of several different media outlets here on campus. It's a TV station that just covers the campus and such. And it's a wonderful thing because it provides the average student who might want to come in and do a Led Zeppelin show every week or a Grateful Dead special every week or a Madonna special every week. They can go on there and do that without taking off a bunch of listeners. Because I can tell you, Dave, and you know from being a volunteer, if we tried to do that here and put on a Zeppelin show every week, we'd hear from the listeners. It's not what the University of Hartford wants being broadcast to the public representing the campus. So a lot of students go there first and spend a year or two there and then often come over here. We also get a lot of students through the Hart School Music Management Program because, among other things, we're an arts organization. We're part of the University of Hartford, but we do almost all of our own fundraising. We do our own publicity. We're running a business with 100 volunteers 24 hours a day at the radio station here. So it's a great way for a student to come in and get some bona fide experience on how to manage. And certainly being a paid professional somewhere, if a student got paid to be a manager of a small staff, that's one thing. But there's also something to be said to have on your resume that you've been program director here and you've had 100 people reporting to you. It doesn't matter if they were volunteers or not. It's a real radio station operating 24 hours a day. So we've given a lot of students, and we've had a lot of students that have gone on from here, graduated and gone on to radio broadcasting and journalism and media and other things too.
Virtually answered the next question I was going to ask you, which is, are students, university students, involved in the running of the radio station in any formal or informal way?
As much as possible. The door is always open here. We are part of the University of Hartford. We always love to have students here. Having been a student here back in the 70s myself and been involved with the radio station since the early 70s, the transition that we've seen, it's really disheartening for me personally, and it took me a long time to really understand what was going on, but it's pretty simple. In the early 70s or even the mid to late 70s, if your college roommate was a disc jockey at the local college FM station, that was pretty cool. It may not have been as cool as having your roommate be the football star or whatever, or the head of the yearbook, depending whatever you're into. But you'd often want to go down and hang out with them. Hey, you want to come down? Can I come down when you're doing your show? There were very few cars on campus. Most students here didn't have cars. There was no internet in existence anywhere. There was no TV in the dorms. Telephones were expensive. There's no cell phones, smartphones. So college radio was a big part of the student environment and the student lifestyle. And radio in general in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was a huge part of the music scene. If you were into music, there's no YouTube, there's no Pandora. You got it from the radio. Or you went out and bought the LPs or later on the CDs. Now there's so much competition. Students are saturated with media that radio means a lot less to them. In fact, I think it's sad to say, but I've never seen a business like broadcasting, but I've never seen a business do a better job collectively of turning new people off. I mean, commercial radio, by and large, has become so homogenized and so mass-produced and so consulted. They have focus groups in Dallas deciding what gets played in Hartford that has turned off a whole new generation of listeners to radio. So we have students here whenever we can, but we went from 100% student operation back in 1968 to being an operation because we're 24 hours a day, because the programming standards are so high, that is predominantly community volunteers operating the station.
You've again anticipated my next question. I was going to ask you to look into the crystal ball and tell us what changes we might expect in radio and particularly in public radio over the next X number of years.
The commercial rating services for radio claim that radio listenership isn't down. They still say that something like 97% of Americans are exposed to radio for an hour or more every week. I don't think that's true. And they actually break that down by demographic and by every decade, for 12 to 20-year-olds, 21 to 30-year-olds. They show young people listening to radio. Up to 90% of young people are being exposed to an hour or more of radio a week. Now, the difference is listened to or exposed to. If they're in mommy or daddy's car and they're 15 years old and mommy or dad are listening to the talk station, well, they're getting exposed to it. But we see, radio has become so bad in this country. The same playlists, syndicated programs, at best, live syndicated programs, and at worst, robo-programming. Most of the stations in Hartford, look at it this way, Dave. After 7 o'clock at night, we're the only station in Hartford that's live. We're live 24 hours a day. All the other stations close the door, lock up, and go home, and it's all a computer system that's running the programming. WTIC, which is an exception, they're so good. They have news programming every hour. They have a news person there overnight. That's what you'd want from the news talk station in town. So I'm not pointing my finger at them, but all the other stations are automated. There's nobody there. And one of the things that we saw, and the Congress saw in Katrina four or five years ago, how radio was so important, because here they are trying to evacuate 4 or 5 million people from along the Gulf Coast there and get people into their cars well, what do you have in your car? You have a DTV in your car? No. I mean, even if you have a TV in your car, it doesn't have very good reception. Very few people do, although I see them. Everybody's got an AM/FM radio in your car. So for disaster and emergency communication, radio is the only game in town. And we saw just 2 years ago when the power went out here in Hartford in the tropical storm in that October, you know, cell phone batteries die after a day. A lot of the cell sites were down. It's radio that provided the emergency communication. So I think radio's, I'm sold on radio. I think radio is really important. But more and more people are turning away from radio because there's other sources there. And because radio has done a pretty bad job of making itself important, we're, I think, the exception. We're trying really hard. The thing that people have always said for decades and decades through many generations, they tune to radio because it's local. It's talking about their town or at least their area, and they like it for companionship. They like to hear voices that are friendly and talking about things. And when you syndicate a show from some station down that comes in from Houston that gets broadcast in Hartford, or when you're just a computer, you know, something's they literally come in on Monday and they voice track stuff all week. That's not companionship to most people, and it certainly isn't local. The station may be broadcasting local, but it doesn't sound it. We're committed to live broadcasting. I can't imagine a time when we were not broadcasting live. So the fact that we provide that companionship, we provide the localism, and we provide a knowledge of the music and of what's going on in town that I don't think anybody else can match. So I see the station continuing to go strong, although radio listenership in general, unless the commercial media tries to reinvent itself, which will never happen, I see radio listenership going down and further and further, unfortunately.
Let's segue into your interest in Hartford radio history. Tell us about your website and about the book that you published recently.
Sure, Dave. I started here in 1970 as a volunteer when I was a 15-year-old high school student, and I came to WWH, and the station really helped me get my career started as a broadcast engineer at Hartford local stations. And all through the decades, I've been working with stations like WDRC and WHCN and WCCC, some of the local stations. And I was a young whippersnapper. Until recently, I think I was a young whippersnapper. And I didn't pay attention to, had a lot of great mentors, worked with a lot of great people, some of which are no longer with us, unfortunately. And I never asked what it was like back then. I was always looking forward. And I wasn't just taking from them. They would show me how things were and stuff. But I never asked. And in preparing to teach a class on radio history about a dozen years ago, here on campus, one of the things that's fun to talk about in radio history is, of course, the War of the Worlds broadcast from 1930s, the Orson Welles and H.G. Wells War of the Worlds broadcast, which was scandalous at the time. And I could picture in my mind's eye several photographs. One was Orson Welles with his hand up to his ear talking to a microphone, coaching the actors and the actresses in the studio. And another one was a picture from the studio of the control room through the glass, and there was an engineer with a straight, thin tie, like the custom of the day, and he had a phone up to his ear, and I remember the caption being, "Engineer takes calls from distraught listeners." When researching for this course that I was teaching, I saw that same picture, and the caption was, "Engineer Harold Dorshug takes calls from distraught listeners." And I realized, my God, I worked with this guy for 20 years. Harold Dorshug was the director of research and development for WTIC Radio from the 50s through the late 70s. He's passed on now. He lived in West Hartford. Amazing man, one of my mentors. And I never asked him what it was like back in the day. And he was there. He was the master control engineer at the Mercury Theater broadcast of War of the Worlds. So at that moment, I realized, you know, somebody should be documenting. Somebody should be chronicling the information about Hartford area broadcasting. So I decided I'd start a website that would cover the dozen or so Hartford radio stations. And that developed into a website that covers all of Connecticut's radio stations because people found this and kept on sending me information. And that worked its way into a book that I wrote just last year called Hartford Radio on the Arcadia publishing label. So it's been a labor of love and a lot of fun to keep this. And most of it was submitted by other people, people that worked in the radio in the old days like to send stuff in. So every station in the state that's here now, and there's also about a dozen stations that didn't last, stations that went on as early. Hartford Current had a station in 1922 that lasted 3 years before it went off. Hartford Times had WTHT, which some of our listeners may recall, that was on from the 40s through the 60s and then went out of business as well. So a lot of historical information on the HartfordRadioHistory.com website.
Well, we'll be sure and check it out. John, you also have a very unusual interest apart from radio, your interest in the Cold War, especially as it played out in Connecticut. We're kind of running out of time, but maybe just Just give us a hint of what you do in that regard, and perhaps we can have you back another time to talk more about it.
Sure. The Cold War website is coldwar-ct.com. It's a collection of photographs and stories about the state's involvement in the Cold War, you know, which spanned over 40 years. Everything is included in there from Nike missile bases, what most people don't realize, that there were a dozen Nike missile bases around Connecticut, and three or four of them had nuclear weapons stationed right in people's backyards in the 50s into the 60s, and best kept secret. You could literally be living there and right across the fence in the back where you knew the base was there, but you didn't know what they had. Fallout shelters, duck and cover, all sorts of neat stuff that's covered on there. It seems to be a lot of people like to look at that stuff and read up on the history of it. So I've got it's probably the topic of my next book, in fact.
You're a busy man, John. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. My guest today has been John Ramsey, the general manager of the University of Hartford's FM station, WWUH.